Well, hello everyone, and welcome to the next instalment of my reading through this very hard to find book, The Character of Peoples by André Siegfried. We're now on the third chapter where we're going to be talking about French culture, French ingenuity, what makes the French a special people. I have to say, if there's not at least one mention of the old baguette and the ring of onions and the stripy jumper, I'll be disappointed, but somehow I doubt it, because despite his quite Germanic sounding name, this character Siegfried was in fact a French author. So he'll be speaking on home turf today, so I'm expecting this to be quite a flattering portrait of the French, but let us see. Just before we get going, it is spring. It is time for my spring sale. Being gorgeous weather here in the UK, some of the nicest weather I've ever seen. And to celebrate it, I've got a sale on at the academic agency, 25% off all courses, promo code Mandy.
A country in which I have spent so much of my adult life and
Promo code Mandy, 25% off all courses. Come on down, academic agency. Every single course, 25% off. Promo code Mandy.
Country in which I have spent so much of my adult life and admired.
All right. Promo, one of my favorite ones ever, that. Okay, so let us make a start then on chapter three. This book is not available anywhere online, from what I know, and it is very hard to get hold of. I don't have time to go through, like, photoshopping every page, so I'm just going to have to look at this screenshot of the contents as I read. All right, he says, "Let us begin by placing France geographically in order to find in her position such factors as will assist to explain the French character. France has three facets, and in consequence of this threefold aspect, she is at one and the same time Western, continental, and Mediterranean. The result is an unusual, perhaps unique, equilibrium. In her Atlantic aspect, France looks outward. She has a window which is opened wide on the world. In consequence, she is susceptible to extra-continental attractions and to adventures far afield. This maritime, colonialist, and expansionist France belongs to the liberal group of Anglo-American civilizations, and it is from this aspect that she appears authentically Western. The persistent west wind, which sows round her shores, brings other things besides the humid and salubrious mildness of the ocean. On the other hand, as continental France, she is held to Europe by living associations impossible to break, and in this respect she is very different from England with her insularity. All the eastern belt of the country, which fell to Lothar in distribution of Charlemagne, is already Central Europe by numerous characteristics, both geographic and moral, which can hardly escape the eye of an observer. From this aspect, the French are no longer Atlantic, but continental, landsmen, essentially Europeans. All history, both ancient and modern, impels us to the conclusion that without Europe, there can be no France. But conversely, without France, there can be no Europe. France is an essential part of any continental system. And finally, in her Mediterranean aspect, France is in direct contact with Africa, Asia, the East, and the Far East. That is to say, in space, with an exotic and wonderful world, and in time, with the most magnificent past of humanity. The fundamental unity of the Mediterranean is an established fact. It is the same everywhere, from Marseille to Beirut, from Smyrna to Barcelona. Thus, the French are related to societies which are no longer their contemporaries, and to forms of culture which Nordic Europe regard as foreign, though the French are attached to them by secret sympathies. Whilst the French peasant is far removed from the mechanized farmer of the New World, one can find certain resemblances between him and the Chinese peasant. The beds and strips of the French Riviera embody the patient labor of innumerable generations. Such artificial terraces evoke the idea of endless generations of men indifferent to the passage of time. The unique character of the French psychology arises precisely from this diversity, which the passage of centuries has finally forged into a new unity. Incidentally, it is an antithetical whole facing both East and West, looking towards both the past and the future, towards tradition and towards progress. There is no country which is at the same time more daring in its ideas and more fixed in its habits. Where France is concerned, and according to the point of view, there is always something to criticize, but at the same time something to admire. It is no easier to place the French ethnically. There is no French race, and that is true to such an extent that to use the term at all signifies nothing. There are Germans in the north, Celts, or if you like, the Alpine race, in the central plain and in the west, and the Mediterraneans in the south. We are, as Cynobos has said, a race of mongrels, but at least we know that too strict a selection does not favour intelligence, and that not all mixtures produce bad results. In fact, the French people seem to have been enriched by these varied contributions. To the Latins, they owe their intellectual lucidity and their gift of expression. To the Celts, they owe their artistic spirit and their individualism, pushed sometimes to the verge of anarchy. And to the Germans, they owe what they possess of organizing and constructive genius. But all these different characteristics have combined into a synthesis which other peoples, the Germans, for example, have never succeeded in producing. The national unity which the French have achieved is not based on race. The ethnic origins may be distinct, but unlike England and Germany, none of the races concerned dominated the others. All French people, whether they originate from the German, the Alpine, or the Mediterranean stem, consider themselves and each other equally French and admit no inequality of any sort as a result of any particular blood which courses in their veins. Could one say as much for the Anglo-Saxon in his attitude towards the Celt, or the Nordic American towards the New York Dago, not to mention the contempt with which the Nazi of yesterday regarded the Slav? French national unity comes much more from an age-old adaptation to the soil, to the climate, and from a historical tradition which has produced and consolidated a specific way of life, a specific culture. It is social rather than political, and the strength of the nation lies in the family, and above all, in the individual rather than in the state. The civic virtues are mediocre in France, but the social cement has the quality of solid rock. Thus, since the individual is the basis of the state, no one will fail to observe that the crisis of French individualism, through which we are at present passing, is particularly grave. By contrast with certain other countries, our present makeup is of long standing. In many respects, it was completed ages ago. Germany, on the other hand, was not really formed until 1870. the United States since the War of Secession, and Russia with the advent of Bolshevism, if we are to assume that there has, in fact, already been a permanent crystallization there. But we should realize that the French personality was complete in the 18th century, and that Frenchmen are not all too sure that such developments as have since taken place have tended to improve it. By comparison, the thing which is most striking about us is that our civilization is adult. The crisis through which we are now passing, and of which, incidentally, we are well aware, arises from the fact that since we arrived at spiritual maturity as a people 200 years ago, two world events of immense significance have come about. On the one hand, the Industrial Revolution has transformed not only the methods of production, but also the conditions of material life. And on the other, the development of the non-European world has upset our standards of measurement, destroyed the proportions between countries, and displaced the center of gravity of the world. The spirit of the new regime, which is spreading all over the world, is based on quantity and not on quality, and the collective action replaces individual initiative. These are both circumstances which go against the grain of our tradition, which is peasant, artisan, and incorrigibly individualist. We must adapt ourselves to the new dispensation. We know that, but we also know that in the process of this adaptation, our best qualities will not always serve us, whilst our faults will stand out as though enhanced. Pretty interesting so far. On examination, the French genius immediately reveals two contradictory tendencies, one which makes common cause with Sancho and the other with Don Quixote. There is, first of all, a very practically, even earthy tendency which expresses itself primarily in the temperament and the traditional attitude of the peasant. The origin of this, I believe, is chiefly Celtic, because erratic, poetic, and imaginative as the Celt is, he is also deeply attached to the family, to the soil, and to everything which roots him in his own environment. It is here that we differ essentially from the Anglo-Saxons and the Nordics, and it is in private life that these traits develop most forcefully. For in public life, one might almost think the Frenchman a different being altogether. From this standpoint, as the head of a family, as a member of the family, or as an individual, the French displays a narrow conception of material interests and an almost passionate feeling for individual property in the Roman sense of the term, uti et abuti, most certainly expresses his feelings in the matter. In his private affairs, the Frenchman is a good sense possessing the spirit of moderation to a remarkable degree. He might almost be reproached for not aiming high enough and for contenting himself with too little. A bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, says the proverb, and he agrees with it. In short, in everyday life, he is a realist with his feet firmly planted on the ground, and he does not attach too much importance to mere words. Generally speaking, the Frenchman manages his affairs well. At least he does when no wars or other catastrophes overwhelm him. His personal property is kept in good order. His linen is neatly repaired, and in a French household, the safety pin is not used for that purpose. He does not like owing money, and his budget is usually well balanced. If currency depreciation makes it impossible for him to keep his affairs in proper order, it is with real regret that he looks back longingly to the days when it was still possible, even at the cost of sacrifice, to make two ends meet. And this is in accordance with the wise financial principles he has inherited from his fathers. This wisdom, this spirit of thrift, which so impresses the stranger, may well lead him into narrowness and provincialism, even to some extent into materialism. But in an old country like this, where money is not easy to earn, it is surely quite natural that once it has been earned, it should be guarded with greater keenness. The American is more generous, but if he loses his fortune, he has a good chance of getting it back again before he dies, or at least he believes he has. The Frenchman has no such illusion. That, however, is only one aspect of our character, and it is contradicted by a no less evident tendency towards universalism, idealism, and disinterestedness. Once his interests are assured, the Frenchman will quickly limit his ambitions and emancipate his spirit by, so to speak, disconnecting action and thought. He is then capable of intellectual objectivity by a process of dissociation, of which I believe only the Chinese offer a second example in the world. We then rise above nationalistic and ethnic narrowness to a ready humanist conception of man. And it is here that our expansive capacity, our ability to liberate the spirit of man and to open the windows of his mind, strikes me as truly incomparable. We have already seen that this trait is of Latin origin, and no doubt it has come to us through that classicism which is the basis of all our education, and to which our deepest national instinct brings us back again and again. Let us try to understand the Frenchman as an individual. It is the surest way of getting at the very heart of the subject, all the good and all the evil, all the grandeur and all the weakness of France come from her conception of the individual, a splendid conception indeed, but one which may well be pathological also. Well, you can say that again, André. Let's carry on. First of all, it is a claim for independence and essentially a claim for intellectual independence. The Frenchman claims to think and judge for himself. He does not look with favour on any sort of authoritarianism, and in consequence, he is profoundly nonconformist and anti-totalitarian. If we find him, fanatically, even blindly, following an order and deliberately sacrificing all spirit of criticism, then you may be sure that it is a result of an equally fanatical devotion to a principle, to a system, to a policy, and certainly not, as was the case in Germany, as the result of any ingrained spirit of obedience. In the United States, they get the best out of a man in the name of efficiency. You can get the last ounce out of a Frenchman only in the name of a principle. In this respect, French thought, whether in its critical aspect or in its fanatical ideological aspect, may properly appear not merely as an instrument of liberation, but as a dangerous and even revolutionary ferment. Where the Frenchman passes, he brings a boisterous current of air with him, which raises the dust and sometimes shakes the structure of states. Pigai, so representative of the profundest instincts of the country, writes, "We refuse to accept the dogmas formulated by the didactic state, just as we refuse to accept the dogmas of the church. It is better to form 100 free spirits than thousands of amorphous and enslaved spirits." End quote. Nevertheless, we are very well aware, and there can be no intellectual independence without economic independence. That is why our demand for intellectual independence is reinforced by the demand for independence in our private lives. Above all, we do not want to be dependent on others, and in particular, not on another, on our neighbour or our superior. Rather than submit to his encroachments, we would prefer, like real simpletons, to commit ourselves to the state, whose dominion is at least relatively anonymous. We also realise that independence demands at least a minimum of security. For a very long time, the Frenchman looked exclusively to himself to provide it, and that explains his deep sense of property, his thrift, and his anxiety to have some security for his old age. Generally speaking, his ambition in this respect is modest. He wants a small house, a small garden, and a small pension. Mon verre est petit, mais je bois dans mon verre. I know the proverb, which is more typical of a certain type of French mentality than this. He says, I know of no proverb which is more typical of a certain type of French mentality than this. I am just imagining all of the French speakers, all of the French watching the video, absolutely tearing their hair out at my butchering of their language there. But I've never been very good at foreign languages, I'm afraid. Sorry about that. Under the Third Republic, the Radical Party, an excellent reflection of our political atmosphere, invariably declined its program, comparatively, so to speak, always claiming to defend the little man against the big, the little businessman, the little property owner, and even sometimes the little swindler. There is a modest cafe in the 8th arrondissement of Paris, which still calls itself Au Petit Ministry. This complex is a curious mixture of idealism and shabbiness. The Frenchman is an egotist. Foreigners often have remarked upon this fact. He knows that money is hard to earn, that once it has been earned, it has to be kept, and that in consequence, it needs to be watched. That is the peasant tradition. As far as the peasant tradition is concerned, and it is never far removed in France, we are, let us admit it, fond of our money, often egotistic, and suspicious of anyone who might want to take it away from us, and in particular of the state. And we are jealous into the bargain, even sometimes envious. But out of these very defects, a singularity, a singularly mature people, an adult people, and this is the essential point, has developed. We can look life in the face without infantility, without hypocrisy, and above all, without illusions. France is a country of moralists. What La Fontaine has expressed in his fables is really nothing but our fund of peasant wisdom. His realism, his moderation, his good sense, sometimes not unmixed with cynicism, express precisely what the French people think about men and things. We are human, and above all, we are civilized. Not so much from the standpoint of material possessions as from the standpoint of spiritual balance. We feel an instinctive repulsion for anything chaotic, for anything which exceeds the bounds of moderation. And we cannot join the Germans in their favourite expression of admiration, colossal. Not too much of anything is one of the favourite precepts used in our family education. And if it is at all possible, we always seek to appeal to reason. An Englishman once expressed astonishment to me because he had overheard a French mother appeal to her son, aged 3, to be reasonable. In the same circumstances, he said, an English mother would have appealed to her son to be a good boy, which is something very different. We are naturally Cartesians, educated by La Fontaine and developing in the tradition of the Greeks, the descending line is the good one. Well, the descending line is a good one. If I were ever asked in what respect that picture is still valid, I should reply that it is accurate to the extent to which it applies to the individual Frenchman in his private life, to the Frenchman of tradition, still instinctively existing despite wars, revolutions, and currency deprecation. But let us not deceive ourselves. It is a type of human being who was formed in an economic and social environment which is fast disappearing. And remember, he wrote this book in 1952. So even when this was written, he was saying this kind of type of Frenchman was on the way out. And we are now wondering how the type can possibly survive in conditions of existence which have become so totally different. There is a conception of labour which is specifically French. It is a traditional conception which has developed out of our most ancient national environment. It is essentially a matter of pride in work well done, of intelligent cooperation between the mind and the tool in an instinctive desire to produce with the impress of personality. The French workman likes to put his individual signature to what he has done. There is no more deeply satisfying gesture than that which the old artisan, his work done, steps back to contemplate it, looking at it with great pride, like God the Father on the sixth day, and finding it was very good. The last word on the subject has been written by Peguai. He seems to like this writer, Peguai. He's quoted a lot here. And the book he's quoting, if you're interested, by the way, is La France. So let me read this. It's P-E-G-U-Y. Peguai. He says, we have known workers who like to work. We have known workers who, when they awoke in the morning, thought of nothing but their work. They got up and at what an hour, and they began to sing at the thought that they were going off to work. And at midday, they sang again when they went off for their meal. To work was their joy and the deep root of their being, their reason for existence. There was an unbelievable honour in labour, the most beautiful of all honours, and the most Christian, perhaps the only one which remains. We have known that piety of labour, pushed vigorously, maintained to its extremest limit. During all my childhood, I saw chairs recaned in exactly the same spirit, with the same goodwill, by the same hands that once shaped the cathedrals of these people. These men were not servants. They were workers. They had honour, absolute honour, as is the nature of honour. A chair rung had to be well made. That went without saying. It was a first principle. It did not have to be well made on account of an employer, or on account of his customers, or on account of connoisseurs. It had to be well made on its own account, for itself, by itself, and in itself. Peguai was not exaggerating. In his youth in Orleans, the Tharodes remind us, and this is another quote now from Tharaud, Tharaud, Jerome et Jean Tharaud. Okay, so this is a pair of brothers, I guess, Jerome and Jean Tharaud. I've not heard of them. Anyway, this is a quote from them. In his youth in Orleans, he had known an old stock whose original culture, formed by local traditions and age-old experience, owed nothing, or practically nothing, to outside influences. A people very close to the soil, a people of worker peasants who were still rustic yesterday, who brought the oldest virtues of the landsman to their crafts, an unbelievable pride to their work, the piety of a job well done. In short, it was very old world, a bygone world, much more closely related to the France of the Ancien Régime than to the France of our day. Its origin, and this is back to Siegfried now, he says, its origin is quite obviously fundamentally artisan, in fact, artistic. The Frenchman can devote himself passionately to creative work, to invention, and then, often enough, he shows no interest in its subsequent application. He sows and others reap. That explains why France is often found at the beginning of things, the motor car and the aeroplane, for example, but not always when the profits are shared. Jean Cocteau has put it with trenchant brevity. France, indifferent, has her apron full of seed and lets it fall negligently. Other peoples come behind her, pick up those seeds and take them away to their own countries, where they plant them in some chemical soil and produce enormous flowers without scent. The question naturally arises whether such original ideas can adapt themselves to the new methods of production. My reply is that they can do so to a much greater extent than one might first think at first glance. Where industrial rationalization is concerned, the creative and intellectually constructive spirit of France finds itself faced with exactly the sort of problem it loves to tackle. What is Taylorism fundamentally? And there's a footnote here saying, Taylorism is a system of work speed up in vogue in France after 1900, named after its inventor, the American engineer F.W. Taylor. So that's the footnote on Taylorism. What is Taylorism fundamentally, if not an almost aggressive affirmation of man's reason as opposed to traditional routine. In this sense, Taylor can be considered, though perhaps without knowing it, as a disciple of Descartes, and the Frenchman, a true Cartesian, can legitimately be regarded as the initiator of rationalization. Was it not the French Revolution which introduced the metric system, against which even today the English and to some extent the Americans still put up a great deal of opposition? Our analytical spirit, our ability to generalize, our language, a precision tool, permit us to reason better than anyone else in the cause of reason. The greatest mistake in our propaganda is to lay too much stress on our literary achievements. There is no reason at all why we should grow humble where technique and what the Americans there should be no reason at all why we should grow humble where technique and what the Americans picturesquely call the know-how are in question. Unfortunately, when it comes to the application as it is practiced today, our qualities are lost. Whether he is a workman, an artist, or an intellectual, the Frenchman, as we have already said, is primarily moved in his work by a feeling of honour. But that is chiefly required. What is chiefly required from a workman today is endurance and conscientiousness. And if it is a question of assembly line work, the ability to suffer the boredom of monotonous, automatic, and anonymous labour. In this sort of work, in which individuality counts for nothing, the Frenchman does not shine. There is no cause for surprise in that. He shows very little enthusiasm and sometimes not much conscience in work for others. I don't give a damn is only too often his attitude. He works really well only when he is working for himself, when he is taken up with something with which he can feel himself really associated. Then there is no limit to his efficiency, but what moves him is neither self-interest nor conscience. Let us make no mistake about that, but a matter of honour. In such circumstances, it is easy to see how dangerous, as far as we are concerned, are the tendencies of a civilization which is becoming more and more a matter of applied technique, in which labour and even more ingenuity have become collective, and in which, above all, individual labour no longer has its proper place. The problem in the present day world is to find a new morale of labour altogether, a morale which is particularly new and strange to us. Our problem is to show the greatest possible consideration to the individual, whilst at the same time recognising that he must merge himself into the collective. France has not yet found the solution to the problem. A point now arises which seems to me every bit as essential to the formation of the French genius as the French conception of labour, and that is our idea of religion. Fundamentally, the atmosphere of religious life in France is that of a Catholic country. Even if many people are no longer believers, the country is indelibly marked by its original and age-old Catholicism. Whether Frenchmen are agnostics or even positively anti-religious, they continue to live, to act and to think in an ambient of Roman Catholic thought. The average Frenchman grows up comfortably in a Catholic environment, and he never feels at home in Protestant surroundings, which seem to him steeped in some strange and foreign atmosphere, and to which he seems definitely ill-adapted. This is the fundamental difference between France and Protestant countries, and it gives rise to a constant lack of understanding, not entirely free of secret hostility, which damages our relations with the Anglo-Saxon peoples. French Catholicism includes a certain very strong pre-Christian survivals, which express themselves in the popular respect, still very lively, for certain days and certain places, which are regarded as sacred in the sense in which antiquity understood the term sacrum. But it also includes belonging to a spiritual society represented by the church in the singular, because there can only be one church, whose benefits are conferred on the congregation through the sacraments by a priest properly ordained and according to a ritual which impinges on life like a kind of mystic ceremonial. The system is based on discipline. The individual submits spiritually, but only in order to recover his liberty on a higher plane. The weak man submits because he needs the protection of that armor. The zealot, the mystic, and the man of action submit because submission gives him a new liberty of conduct. The Church of France is a hierarchy which provides society with a moral frame. Thus, it is a factor which makes for order and its role in the life of the country, not only religiously, but also socially and politically. And this role is enormous. The fact of being a Catholic or an anti-Catholic in France is an attitude not only religious, but also political. And because the church stands face to face with the state as another power, the result is a form of anti-clericalism, which is unknown in Protestant societies. Catholicism has taught us neither the moral responsibilities of the individual nor the practice of political liberty. It has enclosed us in an armor of ecclesiastical discipline, which is not without its grandeur, but which resembles a sort of civil administration for the control of man's mind and morals. To a great extent, the country has submitted to this, but there has been considerable resistance, sometimes in the form of outright scepticism, sometimes by retaining liberty of criticism together with religious practices. The opposition of many Frenchmen has taken vigorous forms. They have left the church, cutting themselves off altogether from its community and proclaiming themselves its enemies. But the majority have remained within its community by a modus vivendi, which permits them to retain their liberty of conscience. As there are hardly any Protestants in France, one can say that all Frenchmen, whether they have remained in the church or not, still bear its stamp. For instance, Voltaire was an authentic product of France and French conditions, and no Protestant country could have produced him. The result of all this is a degree of intellectual liberty in France, which, beyond all question, exists nowhere else in the world. The intellect, radically dissociated not only from dogma, but also from moral imperatives, attains a degree of independence which is unknown to the Puritan English, the systematic Germans, and the efficient Americans. The invigorating and refreshing intellectual attitude which results is a frequent source of wonder to the intelligent foreigner who comes into contact with it. In politics, the result is less favorable. When Catholic France encloses itself in an authoritarian structure, kingship, formerly more balanced, turns towards an absolutist regime. Modern France, the France of the Great Revolution, is the upshot of a double revolt against the authority of the king and against the authority of the church. Unfortunately, this has falsified our ideas, both of authority and of liberty. We have not learned to conceive of an authority which is liberal or of a liberty which is constructive. Contemporary France still suffers from this particular form of original sin. Our attitude, whether in political, social, or private life, is directly affected by all these factors and by the various sources which our national individuality has developed. It is easy to see that what we owe to our Latin or Celtic origin. The qualities we have inherited are certainly good in themselves, but they can easily turn into faults either by excess or because they are badly used. There is, of course, a certain counterbalancing Germanic element, but on the whole, it is inadequate, and particularly in the political form. In France, there is relatively too much Vercingetorix, too much of Numa Romestan. And just as a footnote on these two characters here, Vercingetorix was the leader of the Gauls, captured and put to death by Caesar in 46 BC, and Numa Romestan was a hero of a novel about politics by Alphonse Daudet, written in 1881. What have we actually inherited from the Latins? Asks Siegfried. A social structure which is surprisingly firm, based on the family, which is more solid, stronger, and more lasting than the state itself. but one in which the clan, the system of patronage, and the syndicate can easily mean more to the popular understanding than the interests of the nation as a whole. It is also from the Latins that we have obtained our conception of law, a written and clearly defined law, very different indeed from the common law of Great Britain. To us, in France, the social bond takes on the form of a contract between partners who do not trust each other too far, who are both anxious to make assurance double sure, and are both convinced that you can't have too many legal documents. We are a nation of lawyers, and we certainly do not agree with Rousseau, a Swiss, by the way, that man is naturally good. I like how he disowns Rousseau. Based Siegfried. Okay, let's carry on. That is the origin, probably the most famous French thinker. He's just like, nah, he's Swiss. That is the origin of our conception of the state and of public authority in general. As real Latins, we regard the state as an entity exterior to and superior to the individual and possibly a danger to him. In our eyes, the state is something of an enemy against which we must defend ourselves, and from whose claws we must, in the higher interest of the family, remove as much as possible of what it insidiously tries to deprive us of. Confucius has said that it is quite ethical for a man to rob the state in order to support his old father, and we are not far from sharing his view. Unspoken disapproval is the lot of anyone in France who pays taxes or customs duties without first having tried to dodge the payment. It is not so much that we consider him a simpleton as that we regard him as not having done all he ought to have done. At the same time, we regard the state as an instrument of power, which we must control if we can, if our enemies use it to dominate us, and that, given our character, appears to us intolerable. But if our friends control it and use it and we profit with them, well, then we are undisturbed. This is basically the friend-enemy distinction being pointed out by Siegfried. Here is the origin of that partisan passion which makes our public life so different from that of the British or the Swiss, for whom the state is simply an expression of the community. The contrast between the Catholic and Protestant arises here. For our structure is still Catholic, both in politics and in religion. It is also to the Latins that we owe our reasoning faculty and our powers of expression. The analytical capacity of the French is extraordinary. The least among us, the man in the street, has a singular capacity for generalization, as well as a gift, the gift of discerning the principle involved in a question and the consequences which may develop from it. Thus, in given circumstances, the elector will know instinctively whether the shift is to the left or to the right. As a logician fond of extrapolation, he will see in advance either a reaction or revolution at the end of the road. It is along such lines of demarcation that French political parties move, and in general principles take precedence over practice, to the great astonishment of the stranger, accustomed, as a man of good sense, whose first care is to live, to sacrifice principles. Perhaps this paradoxical attitude comes from our excessive intellectual charity, which makes us define our problems with almost too much lucidity, a circumstance which, far from facilitating a solution, tends to make our problems explosive. Considered thus, our facility for expression appears as a trap. When we compare ourselves with the Germans, entangled in their own tongue and incapable of getting outside themselves, we are astonished to observe the limpidity with which French thought can be communicated. In this respect, we are certainly to be classed more with the Mediterraneans than with the Nordics, though we are really balanced somewhere between the two of them, because of if the sobriety of our language preserves us from the over-eloquent lyricism of the Spaniard. Our classicism involves the intellectual obligation of constructive thought, at which, for example, the English resolutely jibe. From this standpoint, the lychee has impressed an indelible mark on all Frenchmen. We talk a lot about what we owe to the Latins, but not so much about what we owe to the Celts. And yet that heritage is important too. For myself, I am rather inclined to regard it as an essential element of our social and emotional patrimony. In France, people think at once of Celtic mysticism, of the poetry of Breton traditions, and of the romantic charm of the folklore of the Gaul. But it is also from the Celts that we have inherited our sense of self-interest, our tendency to thrift, the seriousness with which we manage our family budget, and our attachment to the soil. The stranger is inclined to regard the Frenchman as a brilliant and frivolous person, incapable of taking seriously anything about it. Talking seriously about anything. How far removed from the truth that judgment is, says Siegfried. When we come into contact with colonies of Frenchmen overseas, in Latin America, for example, we find that those of our compatriots who have been successful in life and who occupy important positions owe their success precisely to those solid and serious qualities, sometimes regarded as a little mean, which they have inherited from their peasant forefathers. In similar circumstances, the Englishman is more pretentious, more the gentleman, but often not so firmly settled. The man from Auvergne and from the Pyrenees or the Alps, Bassis Alps, less gentlemanly, is still in this or that respect provincial, and his earthier origin is still noticeable. But he certainly knows how to look after his own interests. This aspect of our character is insufficiently known, and it is one which is totally at variance with our reputation for instability. What stock is more solid than that which inhabits our central pane and avidly looks after the Sioux? However, it is also the Celts, I fear, that we must look for the origin of the anarchical aspect of our individualism. Brilliant intellectually and artistically, this individualism does not lend itself very well to social achievements. It is here, too, that we must look for the source of that jealousy, that individualist obstinacy, which regards any intervention on the part of the community as an insult. It is also the source of that destructive element in our intellect, which is more at home in opposition than in cooperation. The Latin, who has not forgotten his Roman origin, is capable of conceiving and admiring, if not executing, great political projects. But the Celt is above all an opposer, and to the extent that we refuse, as a matter of temperament rather than of doctrine, the necessary intervention of the community, it is, I fear, the Celt that we must blame. The consequences which arise from this double origin are magnificent in the intellectual sphere, but they can be fatal in politics. The Frenchman, either as a result of his principles or as a result of his egoism, is in danger of falling into a double excess. Sometimes our egoism appears in a truly sordid light, but we make up for it when we sacrifice ourselves to the folly of principles. Robert de Juvenel, a keen observer of the French political scene, declares that for our deputies, the draft resolutions are more important than the laws. And in fact, it is that in their debates, pride of place is taken not by material interests, but by principles, and their passionate devotion to them develops into a fanatical ideology in whose name they are guilty of utterly senseless exaggerations. The fact is that for many generations, France lived in privileged circumstances. She was a country in which the consequences of principles did not necessarily and logically materialize. The Frenchman could pride himself on being a revolutionary whilst leading a peaceable bourgeois existence. he could advocate a demagogic doctrine without any danger of its having the slightest repercussion on his private life. In his Republique de Camarades, Robert de Juvenal, this is not Bertrand de Juvenal, but Robert de Juvenal, I wonder if there is any relation, could write on the eve of the First World War, "France is a happy land where the soil is generous, the artisan ingenious, and wealth evenly distributed. Politics are the pleasure of individuals, but not the condition of their lives." Circumstances have greatly changed since then, but it is doubtful even now whether the Frenchman realizes that his principles can affect the private interests of everyone, his own included, if they are put into practice. The dissociation of the principle and its application, which we discussed previously, is no longer fashionable today as it once was. The Frenchman who votes as an intransigent left-wing doctrinaire is often the very man who, when his own interests are at stake, is capable of the grossest egotism, and the fact that this egotism is perhaps a family nature does not change its essential character. The communist property owner, and how many there are, is ready to defend his property bitterly. Is that just French leftists or every leftist? We all have met somebody like that, haven't we? We would find it scandalous if any attempt were made to impose the Kolkhoz regime on him. And all these people who vote with conviction, even with passion, for nationalization are people who, as we have seen, distrust the state and who, when things they take really seriously are at stake, prefer to rely on themselves. When it comes to the point, they shift for themselves rather as the Chinese do. Incidentally, Paul Morand finds a curious resemblance between them and the Chinese. And this is Morand. He says, "There is a striking resemblance between us and the Chinese, a passion for thrift, the knack of making things last and repairing them indefinitely, the genius for cooking, mistrust, traditional politeness, an inveterate hatred of foreigners, but passivity, conservatism interrupted by social tempests, a lack of public spirit, a great vitality amongst old people who have passed the age of sicknesses. Is the conclusion that all ancient civilizations resemble each other?" It's kind of interesting he keeps on bringing up the Chinese, because another author who did that quite a lot, I remember when I read him, was de Gobineau, Arthur de Gobineau, who's a French. And he was actually arguing that there's a kind of Asiatic character to some aspects of French, the French population, that were actually responsible for the revolution, for the French Revolution, he argues. He had a kind of ethnic or racial, or he calls it blood, but it's a bit more complicated. Read Prophets of Doom by me, the book by me, if you want to know more about Gobineau. But it's just interesting that in a completely different book here, he keeps on bringing up the Chinese as a point of comparison, because, you know, coming into this, I wouldn't have expected any discussion of the Chinese whatsoever. Thus, when the Frenchman comes into contact with public authority, he is tempted to look upon it not as an undertaking in which he is a loyal partner, but as a milk cow from which it is up to him to obtain a maximum advantage. It is not so much the general interest which is involved as privilege, patronage, and recommendation. Everyone in France knows the role of the deputy and how much of his time is taken up in playing the public agent for the private affairs of his electors. The social rentier still believes that the resources of the treasury are inexhaustible and that a nationalized industry can go on running at a loss indefinitely without suffering much inconvenience. A difficult process of education is necessary before he can be made to realize that he is, in fact, not, as he believes, a creditor, but a shareholder in a great undertaking, which is none other than France herself. Despite marvelous gifts, despite an astonishing expenditure of talent and, incidentally, of devotion, what strikes us above all in France is the inefficiency of public life, by comparison with the efficiency of private life. The familiar humorous definition is not lacking in point. One Frenchman, an intelligent man, two Frenchmen, a great deal of talk, three Frenchmen, utter disorder. Okay, I like that. I'll repeat that. One Frenchman, an intelligent man, two Frenchmen, a great deal of talk, three Frenchmen, utter disorder. Should we perhaps envy our neighbours on the other side of the channel? One Englishman, an idiot, two Englishmen, a great deal of sport, three Englishmen, the British Empire. Amazing. Well, once upon a time, anyway. Let us seek comfort, however, in observing the contribution of France to that Western civilization of which she is unquestionably one of the main pillars. If I were asked to say what I was most proud of in that contribution, I should not hesitate for one moment. I should place right in the foreground the splendid confidence of the French in the intelligence of man. In the other words, their confidence in mankind itself. The Frenchman really believes with all his heart that there is a human truth which belongs to all men, that this truth can be grasped by man's intelligence, and that it can be expressed in words, at least with the aid of the French tongue. And for him, and this is essential, thought does not exist, cannot come into existence, unless it is expressed. Up to that point, it is only abstract, that is to say, that in his eyes, it does not really exist, the form of being a necessary condition for its proper existence. Here is, beyond all question, the profound difference between French and German thought. The latter feels at home only in flux, only in the abstract, and feels it circumscribed and debased if it defines itself. It feels itself profound when it is obscure, and our clarity strikes it as superficial. In our thought, we aim at precisely the opposite. We prefer that which is clear, and we believe that which we can nearer the truth when we come nearer to the light. With the Greeks, we prefer cosmos to chaos. We do not claim as our own that which belongs to the kingdom of the night. Our ability to illuminate problems and to choose that which is worthy of being held fast amongst all of the assorted offerings of nature. In this, I believe, lies the real superiority of the French genius. Jean Cocteau, a keen and subtle observer of modern psychologies, has not failed to record it. Germany does not suffer from indigestion. Modern Germany is perishing of all too much approving and acceptance of the educational vulgarization of artistic culture. The German public has a strong stomach. It stuffs all sorts of foods into it, where it is obediently absorbed but not digested. In France, food is often rejected, but in France there are some stomachs which discriminate and digest better than anywhere else. Thought, which becomes conscious of itself, must also be able to communicate itself. The value of our instrument of expression is very high, and it is perhaps here that we have made our greatest contribution to human civilization. Any thought whatever which passes through the filter of French intellect receives order and clarity in consequence, and more than that, it becomes transmissible like money in circulation. It can be used by anybody. It takes on an international significance, and then a miracle takes place, very similar to the act of generation. From the moment that we have given it birth and conferred on it the conditions of its existence, the thought no longer belongs to us. It acquires a life of its own, like a new being. Or to be more exact, we have the impression that, liberated, it belongs henceforth to all humanity. If it is true for us, then it is true for all men. The saying, truth on one side of Pyrenees, ever error on the other, does not come from us. We have sometimes been reproached with what has been called the imperialism of our culture, but no reproach is more unjust. We desire nothing better than to be internationalists of the intellect. The universality is the natural climate of our genius. This is the origin, I believe, of our love, truly sincere and impassioned, for our language, a good tool, tried and efficient. Whilst in his letters to the editor, the Englishman invariably gravitates to biblical commentaries or zoological anecdotes, Frenchmen devote themselves preferably to discussions of grammar. The French Academy, with its famous dictionary, is regarded as being charged with the maintenance of a national patrimony. It is no question of precious over-refinement. The integrity of our culture is involved, for it would be endangered also if its means of expression were endangered. We feel profoundly that our language should be maintained and looked after with the same care with which a good workman looks after his tools. This conception of human thought and its expression has naturally led France to make herself the champion of the rights of man, because in every human being she instinctively respects the thinking man. From this point of view, all men are equal in dignity for France, whatever their nationality, whatever their race, whatever their colour. Pascal's words, "Our whole dignity resides in thought," certainly expresses one of our profoundest convictions. In those countries which seem to regard well-being or power as their supreme object, we invariably feel, after a short period of admiration for their material achievements, a sort of discomfort which is of the spirit. In our eyes, there is no real civilization where men are not human, and in consequence, wherever the Frenchman passes, he is an awakener, even a revolutionary, who, by proclaiming the essentially revolutionary doctrine of the dignity of man, encourages the spirit of intellectual revolt and urges the slaves, the prisoners, and the convicts of totalitarian disciplines, dare to be. When the human being is threatened, when the rights of the individual and the liberty of thought are in peril, men always turn to France, and there is always a Frenchman, whether his name is Voltaire or not, to champion the right of the oppressed. Oh, I wish you hadn't bothered, guys, but anyway, let's continue. It is not from charity or philanthropy. It is something very different. And with this, we have come to the very heart of the West, which without France would not be altogether the same. I know that one could say all sorts of things about our contribution, but it seems to me to be summed up in the dictum of Terence, Humani nihil a me alienum puto. Is it possible to come to any useful conclusion in the face of these contradictory elements? An American, a careful observer who knows our country well, once told me that he had given it up. "Sometimes I see nothing but the faults of the French," he declared. "Sometimes their jog trot, their provincialism, their jealousies, their inability to work together, and then they seem totally insupportable. But the following day, I see nothing but their good qualities, the astonishing ease with which they are able to express their ideas, their confidence in mankind, their enlightened good sense, their generous feelings of solidarity with all men. And then I feel sure that no other people, with the exception of the ancient Greeks, ever attained the level of culture and civilization they have reached." That's the American talking. Renan declared that in many cases the best way of approaching truth was often to be found in the contradictions of a dialogue. And in his Tartarin, Alphonse Daudet did not attempt a synthesis of Don Quixote and Sancho Panza. Nevertheless, among the peoples of Europe, there is none which has gone further. I will not say with effusion, but with what one can nevertheless call the synthesis of historical contributions from all points of a compass. 1800 years of history, in an uninterrupted stream, have made us into the most highly developed of the Western peoples, and, as we have suggested, the most adult. In considering the psychology of the French, one is led to believe that their faults are the inevitable obverse of their qualities, and that such exceptional qualities are on the whole nothing but the utilization and adaptation of certain faults. We tell ourselves, too, that nature has gifted us with a certain balancing mechanism, which always set us to rights in good time and prevented us from landing ourselves completely in the ditch. France, so Catholic and so sincerely Catholic, has also a lay aspect. Her people, indisciplined and difficult to govern, are not really an anarchic people. And if they like a measure of indiscipline, in the last resort, they dread disorder. These grasshoppers are really more like ants, and their instinct for amassing possessions is greater than can be met with elsewhere in the world. And all that is collective, the characteristic of a civilization is weighted and judged not by its peaks, but by its average heights. It is not the creation of great men, but the above average level of the human elements which compose it, and above all, the possibilities of the least among them. In this respect, the fusion in France is more or less complete, whether one is Germanic, Celtic, or Mediterranean, whether one comes from the masses of the people or from the bourgeoisie, the opportunities for achievement and development are exactly the same. Paris has a sophisticated intellectual ambient which gives the impression of a spiritual atmosphere unique in the world. But for strangers who know us well, the innate good sense, the free intelligence, and the splendid human character of the ordinary Frenchman or French peasant are still more arresting. An age-old tradition has developed in France, a country which has, it seems, been privileged up to now, a way of life at the same time, a wisdom well adapted to circumstances. The Frenchman has learned that life can give very much, but that he must not demand everything of it. Perhaps that is true, the only civilization. So there it is. And I, as I predicted, Siegfried, giving quite generous to the French in many ways, certainly viewed from an outside perspective. But I think he touched on many things that seem true of the French people I have met in my life. Certainly, I mean, this, you know, there's the intellectualism, of course, which everybody recognized. You know, more than once when I was reading that, I thought of that scene in Apocalypse Now, you know, of the French, in that chateau in Vietnam, getting really passionate about politics and so on. That's the kind of one of the stereotypes of the French. But this kind of earthy provincial character he talks about is definitely true as well. And some of the more practical elements and the pride in a job well done and things like this. He definitely captured some other aspect of the French that most people wouldn't think about. Didn't mention the stripy jumpers, the berets, or the onions around the neck, unfortunately. But very interesting. Next week, we're moving on to English tenacity. And if the comments for this episode and the last one were interesting, I'm expecting them to explode next week when we get to the English. We've got the English, the Germans, the Russians, the Americans. So lots of fun ones to come. But this was a very interesting look at the French from Siegfried. Promo code Mandy, 25% off all courses while the spring sale lasts in April here. And I will see you tomorrow morning. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just 3 of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, Get out.